From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, a special report covering history's first nuclear attack.
1945, the first atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima. I was 13 years old. I was a normal, ordinary girl, I think. To me, often wonder too, if I didn't get the bomb, what kind of life I had? Often I thought about it. Completely different, of course. Maybe I just ordinarily met men and get married, have a housewife and mother and things. My fantasy goes different directions.
That was Shigeko Sasamori, who was a 13-year-old child when her city, Hiroshima, became the first casualty of an atomic bomb. Thursday marked 70 years since the U.S. dropped an atomic bomb on the people of the city of Hiroshima, Japan, killing a total of about 140,000 and injuring tens of thousands more. CCTV's Terence Terashima reports from Hiroshima.
This sound has echoed in Hiroshima City every year at 8:15 a.m. on August the 6th. People prayed for those that suffered, and those lost their lives may rest in peace. Prayed for peace, that the bitter lessons that mankind have learned would never be repeated. This year marks the 70th year since the atomic bomb was dropped in Hiroshima on August the 6th, killing 140,000, and later in Nagasaki on August the 9th, killing 70,000 by the end of 1945. The survivors still remember the horror they encountered, and their biggest fear now is that these memories might wither, no one to pass on their stories. Aki Norihara was 3 years old when the bomb was dropped. His child memories were vague, some due to shock and confusion, but he remembered the fear. At 8 a.m. on August the 6th, 1945, Mr. Hara, his brother and friends were playing in the riverbank like this, waiting for the barbershop on the other side of the bank to open. Just before 8:15, the brothers were called in for a haircut that decided the fate of the brothers and the friends who remained outside when the atomic bomb exploded just 2 kilometers from the riverbank. The city was reduced to rubble. Those who could tried to survive in whatever shelter they find. Hara said his family witnessed endless rows of people marching towards whatever left of the hospital. Everyone was black, and I could not tell whether they were men or women. Clothes were torn. Their skin was hanging down from their waists. Skin from their arms was hanging, and it came off like a glove. It must have been very painful as they walked with their hands stuck out in front of them. Hundreds walked in pain past our house. Hara said Japanese should continue to take the lead in sending out message of peace and dangers of radiation to the society. The Japanese people have experienced Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We saw how radiation contaminated the fish from atomic bomb testing in Bikini Atoll. We also saw the accident at Fukushima nuclear power plant. No other nation has suffered this much from radiation. We should continue to warn the world of its dangers. Kazumi Matsui, the mayor of Hiroshima, reiterated how Japan and the world should face such dangers.
In order for us to live together, we need to end the use of all nuclear weapons, the ultimate inhumane, pure evil, and the moment to get this done is now.
Many that attended the ceremony said the 70th anniversary should not be the closure for the past sufferings, but a reminder not to repeat the bitter past. Terence Terashima, CCTV, Tokyo.
The two atomic bombs that the U.S. dropped on Japan are the only instances in the history of the human race where a nation has used nuclear weapons. 70 years after the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a new poll by the Pew Research Center showed that most Americans still believe the nuclear attacks on that city and Nagasaki were justified. 56% of Americans polled think the use of atomic weapons against Japan during World War II was justified, while 34% said their use was not justified. The number of Americans supporting the bombings has dropped nearly 30% since the immediate aftermath of the war. A 1945 Gallup poll found 85% supporting it, although the number now appears to have remained steady for the past decade, with a 2005 Gallup poll finding 57% approval for the twin nuclear strikes. For more on that, we spoke with Dr. Mark Sloboda, professor of international relations and security at Moscow State University. We spoke with him via Skype from Moscow Thursday.
A day that should rightly be remembered in infamy, but is instead little more than a historical footnote. And polls continue to show that most Americans feel that the dropping of the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and then 3 days later on Nagasaki was justified. And this is a problem. It is a problem of American exceptionalism, because what is particularly exceptional about the United States is they are the only country to have ever used nuclear weapons on another country, and not on military formations or a fleet or anything, but on what were clearly civilian cities full of civilians, to the tune of deaths of hundreds of thousands. And today, you know, this would be regarded as perhaps an ultimate war crime. And even in the scope of World War II, you know, that crime receives no justification. Everything that historians tell us was that Japan was already beaten into submission. They were willing to surrender, not only because of the U.S. Bombing campaign. The U.S. had bombed 68 cities of Japan, most of them into worse condition and with many with higher number of lives lost, actually, than were lost in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. This was with conventional bombing.
Even the capital, Tokyo, was burned to the ground.
Even the capital, Tokyo, was burned to the ground. We have to remember that, you know, Japan back then was not a city of skyscrapers and concrete. Japan's cities were made
wood.
Of paper.
Yep. They're made of wood. That's right. They were made of wood.
They, according to what, you know, the reading that I have done on the subject, you know, that Japan only had six cities left on the mainland that were reachable by U.S. bombers, that of over 100,000 that had anything left standing that was even worth hitting, that, you know, the Japan was totally devastated already by U.S. conventional bombing. And then on top of that, right when the bombs were dropped, the Soviet Union declared war on Japan, and they rolled through the Japanese, the largest part of the Japanese army, and its entire industrial and resource base in Manchuria, and then equally fast on the Sakhalin and Kuril Islands in less than 2 weeks. And they were poised to invade Hokkaido, which was Japan's actual last redoubt. That's where they had the most cities, untouched cities left because of its northern position. And the Soviet Union would have quite easily taken Hokkaido, and that, you know, there wouldn't have been anything left at that point. The Japanese government, from all of the Supreme Council documents, were counting on their peace pact, their neutrality pact, I should say, with the Soviet Union holding. That Stalin would play a realist game, not want the expansion of Western influence after the war, and would want some degree of Japanese independence. And from that, they hoped to retain some semblance of their government and their way of life. Stalin, for whatever reason, didn't do that. He probably hoped to gain, he did gain the Sakhalin Island and the Kuril Islands. And he had every intention of invading Hokkaido and probably the mainland, main Japanese island as well. But Japan quickly surrendered after, and many historians today, not only Russian historians, but U.S. and Japanese historians even say that it wasn't actually the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki that compelled the Japanese government to accept an unconditional surrender, but it was the Soviet Union entering the war and in such a dramatic and big way so quickly. And that completely obliterates pretty much the last excuse that the U.S. has for dropping the atomic bombs. And we're left with the fact that the most likely reason that the bombs were dropped is simply as saber rattling at the Soviet Union, threaten the Soviet Union and to cement terms of the post World War II world. And I don't think anyone can justify, the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people in such a horrible way with that kind of political thinking.
There's a considerable record of Truman, basically first finding out about the first test of the atomic bomb while he was at Potsdam, I guess, that they were meeting. And
yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And being thrilled, and then his entire behavior towards Stalin changing, and pretty clear from what has been written by the people around him that his intent for dropping the bombs was to demonstrate to Stalin that they had the bomb.
Yeah, I mean, Eisenhower said this in his memoirs, U.S. Admiral Leahy said this, that there was no military justification on Japan for dropping the bomb on Japan, that this was entirely geopolitical and directed at the Soviet Union. There was a particularly atrocious piece of writing. I one of the most sorry and cynical justifications of genocide, and because, that's what it is, dropping an atomic bomb is genocide, in Foreign Policy Today. Titled, "Did Hiroshima Save the Japan from Soviet Occupation?"
Yeah,
this is the mentality that, that was prevalent during the Vietnam War, that in order to save a city, in order to save Japan, we had to nuke their cities and destroy all their inhabitants to save them from Russia.
Right.
It's, I mean, that takes the historical context of Hiroshima, of course, into the neo-McCarthyism of today, but that is entirely relevant.
That's better read than dead. When I was growing up, there were politicians here who were making policy who were saying that, and myself, my family members, and everyone around me being the ones that would be dead rather than read by their choice.
And that is actually an important consideration, because the truth is actually that Japan had a quite substantial communist sympathies among large parts of the population at the end of World War II. And there was lots of different possibilities how the war could have ended, and large parts of Japan could have ended up communist out of this. But the U.S. military occupation, of course, prevented that. And we're still dealing with the legacy of the U.S. military occupation 70 years later today. I mean, you continually see on Okinawa the people just in absolute despair protesting year on year to end the U.S. military occupation of their island. The last Japanese government to be elected just a few years ago, it was only the second time that the opposition party had been elected, the more left of the two, Japanese context, a social democratic party. It had only been elected, this is the second time that it had ever been elected. Japan's history, political history, it's problematic. Problematic to call it democratic in any meaningful definition of the word.
LDP,
they had come to power a few years ago on the promise to end the U.S. military occupation of Japan, particularly Okinawa, where sentiment is at its highest. And they were elected, and afterward they quickly gave up on the notion when the U.S. called them into back rooms and explained the facts of reality to them.
All right.
You are occupied. You will be occupied. We can either shoot you or you can go back to your office and shut up. That's probably
our Asia pivot, our containment of China, our geopolitical notions. Yeah. And we don't trust you. And we cannot countenance that.
And now they've gone full circle in a short period of time with Abe basically abrogating what was left of Article 9 of the peace constitution.
From the U.S. military occupation, the drafting of Japan's constitution under U.S. military rule, Japan is not allowed to have a military capable that can engage in any type of activities except complete defense of their own islands, and that has been, you know, the rules of Japan since since the end of World War II. Japan has participated in many of the U.S.'s imperialist adventures overseas, but mostly through the way of funding providing some specialized peacekeeper units in the aftermath.
Right.
This would really be a change, and the U.S. has kind of changed position on this in that they are willing for Japan to get rid of Article 9 and to have a full, military because, again, of China, because they want a strong Japan to defend against, the rise of China and the threat that China presents to U.S. geopolitical control of the South Pacific and the Pacific in general.
The thing that's interesting is the contradiction that sort of developed along with the change in the, interpretation or reading or application in any event of Article 9. At the argument for the atomic bomb that was made at the end of World War II by Truman and others was that the Japanese people had been trained to engage in guerrilla warfare as self-defense in the event of an invasion of the island.
Sure.
And as they actually developed their quote-unquote self-defense forces, it took on the character of an offensive capability. Rather than being able to protect the homeland and engage, you know, in guerrilla warfare, now they're projecting power with a navy and air force.
Yeah.
It's an interesting contradiction.
It is. And it has to be said, however I look at this from a realist perspective, there is a large portion of the Japanese population, according to the polls, that do not want to get rid of Article 9, that they are quite happy being a pacifist, quote unquote, nation. There are large protests in Tokyo about this. In the end, will the Japanese people vote solely on this issue? No, probably not, any more than Americans, would vote primarily on military or foreign policy issues. In the end, it always comes down to, the family purse and identity issues, so on. This is definitely an issue for Japanese domestic politics, and probably the best way for Japan to resolve this fairly is with a referendum.
Yeah, that's true. And you know what else? If you're thinking about the reality of Japan being still occupied by the United States 70 years after World War II, and the U.S. basically shutting down the democratic expression from the Japanese people that they wanted the U.S. out, having their own military legally might be the first step towards asserting their own independence.
I was just going to say that. You're stepping on my brain there.
Sorry about that.
You know, certainly not at first, right? That wouldn't be. But down the line, right, having their own military would inevitably lead them down a path of greater independence, from U.S. control.
Going back to the time at the end of the war when these decisions were being made, the Soviet Union was almost in a position to begin physically occupying the northern part of Japan. They did take the islands already, and they were, moving in.
Yeah, they already, absolutely, there's no question. They had taken Sakhalin, they had taken the Kuril Islands, and they were all poised for Hokkaido. And part of this really nasty argument in foreign policy that I already mentioned is that dropping the bomb on Hiroshima saved the island of the northern island of Hokkaido from Soviet military occupation. And I think that's a really cynical and facetious argument.
I'm thinking from looking at what was happening at Potsdam and from the earlier conferences, actually, and then seeing it manifest over the period of, you know, from the late 40s, it seemed that what Stalin had in mind to do, to come out of the war with, because of the fact of encirclement of the USSR before World War II, or the, you know, the attempted and pretty much implemented encirclement of it, was to move the walls out.
Let's clear up something right there. It is not simply a matter of the post-World War II containment of the Soviet Union. The Western powers, including Japan, actually invaded the Soviet Union.
That's right.
In 1919 to 1921.
That's right.
This is a part of our history that is completely forgotten, a part that directly is the real start of the Cold War.
Right.
The U.S., the U.K., or the British Empire then it was,
right.
The French Empire,
right.
The Japanese Empire, all combined together to launch an invasion of what was then the nascent Soviet Union to attempt to put a czar or some other more Western amenable form of government in the Soviet Union.
Right.
And they attempted to strangle communism in its grave. That's even the way it was phrased quite enthusiastically at the time.
That's right.
And in the course of this, right, something that is completely forgotten in our mythologized personages of the time period, Churchill, who was in charge of the British military expedition that invaded Arkhangelsk at the time, used chemical weapons.
That's right.
Yep. On the Soviet people, on the Russian people in this case, because that's, you know, where it was. So the whole thing failed utterly. Because the Western powers, did not meet with initial success. They were surprised by the strength of support for the Bolsheviks at the time, by the general population, and, you know, the resistance to them, of whatever kind from the Russian people in general. They quickly turned tail and fled after a few years and, kind of tried to erase it from the history books. But the Russian people remember it very well, and they mark it as the start of the Cold War, the real start of the Cold War, where the West just erases its from, you know, its notions of history and its painting of the Soviet Union as this evil force that intended on dominating the world. And that is the space of containment that you were talking about. It was actually an invasion.
Yeah, so what I'm thinking, Stalin, knowing that, because he was there when that was happening, is looking at, in the post-war area, buy me buffers. If they're going to surround us, let's push them the hell out so that they have to fight just to get to our borders. And that perhaps the approach to Japan was part and parcel of that deal.
Absolutely, in the Pacific. I mean, first of all, the suffering, the amount of losses that the Soviet Union took in its defeat of Nazi Germany, and we have to recognize that by and large, the European theater in World War II was a defeat of Nazi Germany by the Soviet Union, with some assistance from the United States and the United Kingdom. This was definitely, it's a basic fact of geopolitics that Russia doesn't have many physical boundaries that protect it. Part of that, of course, is it's such a very large nation. But, there aren't any mountain changes or so on.
Right.
It's a big, flat, open plain that has been used to invade Russia, from the east, from the west. That is the Eurasian plain. So, of course, they wanted space. Space is what saved the Soviet Union in World War II. Space is what saved the Russian Empire from the Napoleonic invasion, as well as the Swedish invasion earlier.
Mm-hmm.
That has been, they call it strategic depth, that they are willing to trade space, for time to reorganize and mount a defense and draw out the logistics and supply lines of their attackers. And it has worked. And, you know, look at the size of Russia. It's pretty much impossible to believe that how it couldn't work. So certainly that was, you know, everyone had a very different mentality of that time, and everyone wanted spheres of influence, protection, and so on. And everyone was gearing up on both sides for the, you know, the post-World War world. And, you know, we see that with, as well as Stalin's machinations to, you know, cement complete control of Poland and Bulgaria and Romania, as well as the British assistance in Greece to bomb the communists in the country and rig the elections there and in Italy. So, you know, it was a time when what was openly done would not be accepted now. Of course, many of the same things are done now. It's just cloaked in covert and, you know, post facto legitimizing legal arguments.
If you look at a map, though, the story's pretty clear, because Ukraine is a lot closer to Moscow than, say, the frontier with Poland was.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, and, you know, the Ukraine is far more, is that, you know, half of Ukraine is populated by people that feel themselves to be very close to Russia. So more than geopolitics, geoculture also comes into the issue. That's why Russia is looking at modernizing its military so quickly and so drastically at this point, because they feel they face multiple credible threats.
The United States, the United States moving of a missile shield closer and closer to Russia has to be looked at as a serious threat to engage in a nuclear war, or to have a stand down with the threat of nuclear war.
Of course, because the biggest threat of any ballistic missile defense is not only the removal of the mutually assured destruction, the strategic, deterrent, but also the possibility of first strike capability, which is even scarier. And we certainly know that those things have been discussed in the annals of American history. Immediately after Obama penned the executive agreement with Iran, on the P6 plus one with the Iran deal, Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, immediately made a remark that, oh, I guess the U.S.'s ballistic missile defense shield, which is supposedly aimed at preventing a non-existent Iranian nuclear weapon from hitting Europe at the cost of billions of U.S. taxpayer dollars, being erected in Eastern Europe, it's no longer needed. And this was simply, epic level trolling, because everyone of any serious, military strategic thought in the world who isn't completely a paid propagandist, you know, knows and will acknowledge that the missile shield is aimed against Russia. And Putin has remarked on this several times, first in Munich in 2007 and at least two times since then. The U.S. has a very paranoid and dangerous conception of security at this point, where they demand absolute security, which of course means that every other country in the world must be completely vulnerable to them to provide them with this absolute security. And this is a recipe not just for war, but for world war. The U.S. is not the ruler of the world. It needs to accept that point that there are other great powers. And its continuing attempts to prevent any power from arising that threaten its current semi-hegemony, suzerainty, whatever you want to call it, over world affairs, nominally in the name of its security interests, which extend throughout the entire world, it's a really dangerous recipe. Besides draining the bank accounts of every American and putting the country $17 trillion into debt. And I think really the American people need to look at this, need to take a serious look at this, need to recognize that, you know, what we call foreign policy and military interests abroad is very much a domestic economic issue affecting their own wallets at home.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.